to this morning, and probably the non-professional when I look around the room, Dr. Mala Jadeja. She's going to speak about some work that she's been doing for the last year at least, but perhaps even before that. Mala's had many leadership roles in residency education here at Queen's. She was the director of our international medical graduate program when that was a whole burgeoning new program for us. We don't really need that. They're just integrated into our programs now, but she took that role and led us with that. She's the program director for rheumatology. She's the associate program director for core internal medicine. So in all of those leadership roles, she's started to learn things about the residents and resident education that are perhaps not as well known to the rest of us who are just blithely going about our business every day. So Mala became our first Phoenix Fellow at Queen's University. She has the AMS Phoenix Fellowship and is actually being funded to do this very interesting work. And I've invited her to speak to us about her work. So thank you for joining us, Mala.
Thanks very much. So I'm very happy to speak to you about my work today. When a person is asked to speak, he or she can't help but reflect on what he or she has been doing and how things have been going in general. And also, as the person's doing this, many new ideas came to mind. So it's a little bit dangerous getting new ideas, but it's also very, very helpful. And this is my work in progress. And I think just to frame it, what we're going to talk about is what I have been working with. It's all in the form of postgraduate medical education. It revolves around critical incidents. The idea is to promote certain values in residency care. And so what we'll talk about a bit is the project itself, the goals, the use of critical incidents. It really comes down to professionalism and the development of physicians. So I gave the title for the rounds, Critical Incident Narratives in Residency Education, What Can We Learn? And I'm going to ask you this question at the end. What do you think we can learn from this? The project that I proposed for the AMS and Fellowship is called From the Ground Up, Using Critical Incident Narratives During Residency Training to Promote the Development of Professional Physicians. The goals of my project have been to design and implement and evaluate an educational program for residents to promote the development of compassionate physicians, and to use insights gained from this program to help shape future educational strategies. And just to put a concrete example of what that could be, and I'll talk about this again later, this could be the project being presented at the level of the Deanery Graduate Medical Education Committee, to where the results presented to people who can make a difference in future education. So the solid objectives of my project have been to design and implement a curriculum for PGY1 to PGY5 residents using critical incident narratives to address the issue of patient-centered care and hidden curriculum. And the reason for choosing those things I'll tell you in a minute. I wanted to collect critical incident narratives in residents to produce sustainable teaching materials for future years so that we could use some examples to carry forward. I want to qualitatively analyze the critical incident narratives, and I wanted to use the results to prepare a plenary or workshop for acute care. So this is in line with the AMS Phoenix Project. The Associated Medical Services put forth the Phoenix Project to bring back caring to medicine. One of Brian Hodges, who's the project leader, his paragraph started out with, that medicine has lost its way, and we need to balance compassion with the technology that is advancing. So in alignment with the AMS Phoenix Project, my educational program would address two key concepts in the education physicians, the patient-centered care, and the hidden curriculum. The critical incident narratives to be used as a teaching method to cover these concepts. And the rationale for focusing on patient-centered care in the new curriculum is that both of these are key to the promoting the development of compassionate physicians. So it came after looking at the goals of the AMS Clinic project and thinking about what I wanted to do. It came down to that we wanted to look at these three very distinct values in medical education, postgraduate medical education. One was patient-centered care, one was compassion, and the other was the awareness of the curriculum. And so you can see how they're all a little bit interrelated. So patient-centered care, we focus on the patient and the good connection with the patient, does promote compassion, and to provide compassionate care, you should be connected with your patient. And the hidden curriculum is thought of as usually a negative influence that interferes with our ability to promote these values. So that's how, in my mind, I connected these three things. So the hidden curriculum we learned about at last science education rounds. It's a challenge that is faced by educators who want to change aspects of the culture of medicine. It deserves a talk and probably a conference on its own. And for some, the hidden curriculum seems to work against the integration of patient-centered care into the environment of medical education. So, critical incidents. I think I became interested in the idea of critical incidents when Dr. Van Mel and I would talk about transformative learning theory, and we would talk about disorienting dilemmas and incidents changing the way we think about things. And I think this is something that resonates with me very strongly. If you are the kind of person who reflects on experience and is affected by experience and listens to other people's experiences and walk away with things even just from listening to other people's experiences, this will resonate with you as well. So critical incidents are used in medical education. They are defined as important and particularly memorable events, either positive or negative, that encourage trainees to re-examine their ideas, values, and attitudes. They are generally integrated into medical education using a variation of the critical incident technique that was designed by Flanagan, and that was in U.S. Aviation. In critical incident analysis, a report of the incident or a narrative is coupled with a reflective piece. So the analysis includes a description of what happens and then the reflection after. So in the literature, there are many programs, especially for teaching professionalism, that are described. And those often use critical incidents, and they're often aimed at the undergraduate level, the undergraduate medical student level. And this actually makes a lot of sense. There's, if you think of undergraduate medical education, that transition time from when undergraduate students become classroom attendees and participants to participants in the care of patients, so at their clinical clerkship, that transition period is considered to be quite, to have a very strong impact. And it's most people who have looked at the human curriculum want to look at that point because that's kind of the change point for undergraduate medical students. And I think that makes a lot of sense. But the more time I spend with residents, as Dr. Flynn mentioned, the more I see that residency training is probably just as an appropriate time. The difference, I think, in residency training is that residents are given responsibility, and they're the ones who are giving news to the patients. They're the ones who are there. They also have selected their course of training and are working more closely towards what they want to be, when they grow up. So I think residency is a very appropriate time to look at these things, and you can tell me what you think after I tell you what we heard. So just to elaborate on that, I see that residents are the frontline physicians. I see that they're exposed to positive and negative role modeling, and I believe that the reinforcement of teaching professionals professionalism and awareness of the human curriculum is actually very much necessary in residency teaching. As for a critical incident, I believe that a residence daily experience is rich with possible critical incidents, and you just need to go to lunch with a group of residents to hear what they talk about. And critical incidents that are, the use of critical incidents is supported by the theory of reflective learning and transformative learning theory. So it's a tool and a method that's actually based in educational theory. Medical student did a critical inquiry project with me where she looked at the literature and looked at use of critical incident narratives, how many of these projects or how much of this work was actually supported by theory and that theory was referenced. And about 40 to 50% of the time, theory was referenced, but 40 to 50% of the other 60 to 40% of the time, it wasn't. So I think that people know that it's a good tool to use, but it does have a basis in theory. And according to transformative learning theory, there is a potential personal transformation and thus enhanced professionalism. And critical incidents stick with people because of their personal nature and because they originated in the trainee's own professional life. The idea that's appealing about transformative learning theory is that this learner who has been transformed is not allowed to do things as they did before. And it has thus the potential to influence the professional development of physicians. So when I applied for the Phoenix Project, I did put one sentence in that it might sound like this is a very ambitious goal. But it probably is ambitious, but I think you'll see that it's worth pursuing. So the steps that I outlined for my project is that I wanted all program directors at King Queen's University to be invited at the postgraduate medical education level to have their residents participate. Dr. Ross Walker was very supportive of this. I presented my project at a PGME committee meeting and asked if program directors would like to have their residents participate. The first step I wanted to put forward is visit each of those residents' programs and introduce them to the Phoenix Project, the concept of patient-centered care, and the hidden curriculum, and individualize my presentation for each specialty program. In the initial meeting, I wanted to ask residents to think of critical incidents and then ask them to prepare written narratives related to these incidents and send them back to me. The next thing I wanted to do was do a thematic qualitative analysis of the narratives across and within the programs. Then go back to the residency programs and talk about some of the themes that came up, keeping it specific to the residency program. Another goal of mine was to take my experience thus far and prepare a workshop at QCARE. And QCARE was just a couple weeks ago, and we had a workshop there on the hidden curriculum. My further plan was to look at the results and make up the thematic analysis and really review these with the program directors and the postgraduate teams, and then produce some recommendations for future interventions. So the project, the collection of the narratives, was given ethics approval. There was a recent article in Academic Medicine about the ethics of doing research in postgraduate medical education. It was from the States. It was called GME, Graduate Medical Education. And it outlined some of the issues that come up in the ethics of doing such research. But the main statement from that article was that you must go through ethics to do research in postgraduate medical education. So, from the ground up, I'm going to start to tell you about what's been happening and what we found. I'm going to divide the work into two different parts because it kind of has become two different things. I'm going to talk about the residency program meetings and the narratives that I've collected from individual programs. And I'm going to talk about our acute care workshop that just happened. So, the residency program narratives. The story so far. So, the following programs came forward and asked me to come and participate and describe my program and the interest. So, ophthalmology, critical care, gastroenterology, radiology, medical oncology, radiation oncology, internal medicine, physiatry, I left off psychiatry, pediatrics, and OB-GYN. I apologize. I didn't want to talk to psychiatry.
That's a phrase.
I was looking at this slide last night. I was thinking, I know there's another program. So interesting, because you've got two subspecialty programs, critical care and gastroenterology, and you've got some procedural specialties like gastroenterology, ophthalmology, OB-GYN, but no real primarily surgical specialties. And I'll come to that in a bit. So what I did was I planned to have an initial meeting, and each initial meeting, I did have an initial meeting with all of these programs, including psychiatry, and I went there with Nancy Craig, who's the research assistant working on my project with me, and we spoke about patient-centered care. We mentioned compassion and the care curriculum, the importance of critical incidents and narratives. And I also, for each meeting that I went to, I did a literature review about these issues and that particular specialty. So I wanted to talk to them about their own specialty. And some things came out. So for example, there was in the radiology literature, there was an old commentary about career choice in medicine and how radiology is an excellent career choice and so on and so on. And in pediatrics, there was literature around compassion, especially in palliative care in pediatrics. And in OB-GYN, there was a curriculum for reflection that was presented in the literature. And in ophthalmology, there was a lovely article on patient-centered care and patient expectations. So I tried to put these into the talks that I gave in individual programs. So I requested narratives from them, and I plan to review the themes and come back for a second meeting. So this all started in October and November, and we received 27 narratives. And we didn't, there were some programs where we had we didn't receive any narratives. So we received narratives from ophthalmology, critical care, physical medicine, rehab, medical oncology, psychiatry, internal medicine, and OB-GYN. And this was a little bit less than I expected, because when I did talk to the residents, and I know that you two go and you talk to the residents, and you say, would you like to do this? And they say, oh, you know, of course, Dr. Chaneja, we'd love to do this. But there's a little bit more to it than that. It's just not that as straightforward as it sounds. So they've been slow coming in, we've got 27, and they're all excellent. They're all excellent. So there were some issues with process. So I didn't go and sit with them, with Nancy, and say, you know, can you write this narrative? I gave them the opportunity to think about what I had discussed with them and ask them to come back with the narrative. And that was my personal preference because I had wanted to give them the time to reflect. So that it may have been part of the issue. The other thing was that I went to their academic cafes, which is, in theory, great if you want to go meet the residents. But when you go to an academic cafe, there are a lot fewer residents at the academic cafe than you might expect because some are off-service, some are post-call. And I had planned to go to three academic cafes during the period of a year, and not all of the same residents will be at those three particular half-days. So academic half-day is very valuable, but it's not necessarily the forum where you can have every resident present or even the majority of the residents present. So then I sent out requests, and I got two different reactions to requests. One was from my own residents in Tremes and said, can you just keep reminding us? You know, just send us a reminder every week and we'll do it. I need a reminder. And then from another group of residents said, why are we keep getting these emails? You know, Okay, so fine. And then we arranged the second meeting and got a few narratives, and we arranged a second meeting. And at the second meeting, with very few narratives, we decided to talk about the process of giving narratives. And what we found was there was a lot of hesitation. Part of it was time, part of it was, you know, you didn't send enough reminders or enough deadlines. There was a real hesitation. And the hesitation was not sort of a homogeneous, you know, we're just really busy, or there was this idea of that I don't want to talk about this and I don't want other programs to hear about what's going on. And if I describe this incident, Kingston is a small enough place that someone will figure out who I'm talking about, which attending staff I'm talking about, even maybe which case I'm talking about. There was a really strong hesitation on that part. And the second hesitation was that, you know, I have a lot of stuff to do, and unless my program director says that this is mandatory, I'm not going to do it. So that was more in my minor, but this hesitation about Kingston being a small place, and I don't want this shared. I don't want this shared across programs. What if Dr. Janeja would start talking about this, and then the residents in the program will understand exactly which case I'm talking about, because everybody knows this particular case. So a lot of hesitation. So we had these discussions about the concerns, and we spoke to them. We said, well, you can have the option. We will not discuss it at all. We will use it for thematic analysis. We will discuss it only at your program level. We will only discuss it with other programs, or use it as an example, or use it themes for other programs if you give us your permission. So we spoke a lot about the consent. And this was after having gone through ethics and having a consent form. So what I learned from this is that in this kind of research, you have to plan for all different possible questions and all different possible scenarios. So I talked about some of the concerns that we came on ahead. So I went to a bit of a different direction than I hoped with the second program. We spoke very openly about the concerns that we had. And for the programs, I also, you know, I'm moving forward with the second meetings, and I've been focusing on issues in that particular specialty. So if it's a procedural specialty, we're talking about patient-centered care around procedures and the hidden curricula and then role modeling. So I've still been able to talk about a lot of things, but I have some more work to do with the narratives. What has come out of the meetings that we've had, and just a preliminary analysis of the narratives, is that the thing that resonates most out of those three things that I took to the residents is a hidden curriculum. This is the thing that resonates most with them. And there are specialty-specific issues. There are issues in the curriculum that are specific to specialties. And there are negative issues, and then there are positive issues. And to me, that speaks to the value of role modeling. So I'm planning to do a second meeting with each program, and each of the program directors has allowed me to come back. Oops. Has allowed me to come back, and I will pursue the second meeting. Doing what I can with the narratives that I've received, but making it still specialty specific. And then I plan to, after having thematic analysis of all of the narratives, go back and present my results to each of the residency programs so that they can see what they have contributed to and what the other residents are saying, and it will be strictly in the discussion meetings. So, I learned also about this is that my work had kind of a dual purpose, and the purpose was to bring these issues to the residents, the compassion, patient-centered care, and the curriculum. But I also wanted to collect information. So the idea itself was educational, but there was also this purpose of collecting information for research. And I think this is a very common issue in postgraduate medical education research, and the whole process has made me think much more specifically about different issues that have come up. So I certainly have learned a lot from this. What I took away from my work so far in this area is that the hidden curriculum resonated so strongly with them that I wanted to do the entire QPR workshop only on the hidden curriculum. So I ran this by Dr. Walker and Brigitte, and everyone said that this is an important topic. It's, you know, on the top 10 list of that educators want to address, so go ahead. So we had three workshops in the sense that the QPR is in 2 days of academic residency education, where the PGY1 residents are pulled from their services and to attend a conference. And it's set up very much like an academic meeting. And they have plenary sessions and concurrent sessions. So we had a concurrent session, which was a workshop, where we had approximately one-third of the residents at each time. And we had an hour-long workshop. So the workshop went like this. I introduced them to the concept of the hidden curriculum. I gave them a 5-minute talk. I asked them to write a critical incident narrative that where they felt that the hidden curriculum had come up in their training. We gave them some line paper to write on, and we asked them to write the narrative there and then. We gave them 10 minutes to do that. Then we gave them about 15 minutes as they were sitting in small group tables to talk about the narratives in their small groups. And then the last 10-15 minutes, we asked a couple people from each group approximately to share their narratives with the large group so that we could comment and everyone else could comment on them. And then we collected the narratives at the end. So it was really interesting. So we focused on the hidden curriculum. We collected 89 narratives. And let me tell you a little bit about the process and a little bit about the results. So the process was like this. I spoke to them about the hidden curriculum and why I thought it was important. I gave them a couple, a list of examples that I had taken from the literature. And I also had written two short narratives myself because I thought, if I'm going to ask them to do this, I better make sure that I can do it. So on the weekend before, I sat down with the line paper and pen and said, you know, you have to think of some narratives to write. So this is just speaks to the value of critical incidents, because I wrote two narratives from my residency education, which was a long time ago, and they were crystal clear in my mind. So then they had a small group discussion, and that was so valuable. You know, you really just had to see their faces as you were walking around. That happened to you? Did that really happen? You know, and they could have talked for a long, long time, and I felt like I was, when I wanted to bring them back to the large group, that I was actually cutting them off, and didn't want to interrupt them. They were having such, and they were actually, each one was presenting his or her narrative in an order around the table. It was a really valuable discussion. And a resident told me yesterday she thought that was the most valuable part of the workshop, because it allowed her to see that other people experience the same thing. So they gave very insightful descriptions, and some of them are quite emotional. They were insightful in the sense that one resident actually described how the structure of a particular hospital she thought was gender biased towards female surgeons. And they were emotional in the sense that one resident spoke to both of these residents spoke to a large group and said, you know, this happened to me. And he was clearly emotional. He was clearly holding back sort of his emotional reaction. So there was a lot of emotion there. And hearing stories told to the large group, I wondered if maybe we should have a longer workshop where we would have had more time to discuss these things. So what we plan to do with the narrative, so this was just on the 13th and 14th of May, so it happened very recently, is we want to look at the context. You know, are these happening in the surgical area, in the emergency room? We want to look at the role of role models, the teaching environment. We also want to go through each of them and see which CanMed role is being looked at in each of the narratives. And then particularly I'm interested in their reactions and this idea of transformation, because I have a sense that people hear that, you know, I will never do this again, or I will never do this like that. I sense that we'll hear that. So Nancy went through most of the narratives, and some of the first impressions that we're getting of her themes are that the teaching and learning environment is being described, elements in this environment is being described. People are talking about the first experience, the first time they pronounced someone dead, the first time they were on an overnight call by themselves. And I think this is where it differs a little bit from Clerks. It's a level of responsibility. The first time I was covering all these patients by myself. The context, there's a lot about career choice, especially related to family medicine. Why did you go into family medicine? It's a waste of time for you to go into family medicine, things like that. Resources, I wanted to do this for a patient that I couldn't. And the pressure to discharge patients, which is really very strong in the hospital. Other themes that have come up, hierarchy, opportunities for teaching. I wasn't able to attend this surgery. There were too many learners, things like that. Talk about incorporating reflection, a few instances of reporting adverse events, things around teamwork, observing what their preceptors are doing, observing how their preceptors are doing, and the time extremes. So some of the issues that, you know, come up are attitude towards family medicine residents, communication issues, a lot of issues around professionalism, the structural issues, and patient safety and resident safety. Often residents would mention marginalized patient. They would use humor. They would talk about their own self-care and decision-making. So there's a lot of information that we're going to get from these narratives, and I'll have to come back and tell you about it. So there's some limitations. This is handwriting. So doctors have the neatest handwriting, as you know. I was actually pretty impressed. I was worried about this, but and there were some that we couldn't decipher, but overall I was pretty impressed. Went to the early in their careers, so. And so we had no opportunity to ask questions or clarification or debriefing them, since they gave us a narrative and that was it. And we couldn't observe the writer, so we couldn't be there when they, it's not the same as someone telling you a story verbally that you can see their facial expressions and stuff. And then I did give examples. So I gave examples from the literature and I gave my own examples. So there may have been influenced by that, but I wanted to really point them in the right direction. So back to the whole idea of critical incidents. So are critical incidents valuable? I think that they really are. The value of these is reinforced by narratives, and they're a great basis for discussion. They are just a great starting point for discussion. But they're not always easy to discuss, and they're personal, and there will be some hesitation in sharing these personal stories. So what can we learn? What can we learn from critical incidents? So I think what we can learn is we can learn what is happening. So we will learn about the stories. And I kept thinking about this in the last couple of days especially. If you hear one story, if it has such an impact, should it be the catalyst for change? Now there are lots of precedents for this, right? You hear one story, and things, because of that story, things were changing. And this is an extreme example, but you must have heard this example where son put a hidden camera in his mother's nursing home room to document that, and that's been on the news. So what will, I kept thinking, you know, what will come of that? What will people do with that? That's one story, but what will people do with that? So I think there's value in stories, of course, and there has to be value in multiple stories and what comes out of this. I think from the narratives, we'll get a picture. This is what the Haven curriculum looks like. This is what the residents are seeing. I think we'll see a lot about the stressors in residency, and I think we'll get a description of the teaching and learning. I would like to consider maybe, if I pursue this work, to look more at what are the connections between residents and patient-centered care, and what compassion, how do they relate to these two things? But right now, the main theme that's coming out is the hidden curriculum. So what will I do going forward? I will analyze the resident awareness, hopefully come back to health sciences education rounds and present the data to you. Continuing with the educational programs and all of the programs that we bring to it. I actually have also been asked to come to speak to anesthesia, and I had a surgical resident come up to me and said that she wanted to pursue this and work with me for the surgical program, so I'm going to make that a mission for next year. We had one resident who consented to having his story, which is really actually a humorous story. We're going to make that into a video that we can use for teaching. I hope to continue the acute care workshop. I thought about over the, if I'm committed to continuing the acute care workshop, asking for residents to give one positive example and one negative example of their teaching environment to sort of balance things. And then I thought about having a different workshop where instead of addressing the hidden curriculum, we talked about patient-centered care in the residency, or we talked about compassion. So there are lots of variations that I have on this idea. So as I was putting this together, I was thinking about, you know, everybody's different perspectives, and I told you a bit about the residents' perspective and what they thought. My gut feeling is that these things are all very important to the residents: compassion, patient-centered care, and the hidden curriculum. Obviously, resonates with them very much. But they're in a very busy, stressful work environment in the teaching hospital. They have a lot of other things on their mind, but this really shouldn't get lost. I think it needs to be nurtured in them. And I think they're open to it. I know that they feel reluctance in talking about some of their stories, but I think that stems from the hierarchy, and it does stem from our community being not very big. The program directors have been very supportive, if only to just continue to allow me to sit with the residents and talk with the residents. I have reflected on my own role, not as a researcher, but as a faculty, in when I go and talk to these residents. I do know them, and some of them did come through rotations with me, and I've seen them in the hospital. Some of them I taught in clinical skills as when they were undergrad students. So I'm not that distant from them, and there was an article by a commentary by Susan Phillips in Medical Education. She suggested that someone from completely from the outside should be the one to evaluate the hidden curriculum. Then what's going to happen to me? What am I going to do? and then as a researcher, and I have to continuously think that I have to continuously remind myself and think that, you know, there's something really good that is going to come of this. And let me talk to you about that in a minute. So I want to present the results, report back to the AMS Civics Project, disseminate the results, and then I'm going to take the results back to the resident. But I predict that there's going to be a conversation, a serious conversation with either the dean at the School of Medicine or the associate deans that, you know, this is what the hidden curriculum is looking like here, and what are we going to do about it? And I don't know how that's going to look, what that conversation is going to sound like. I don't know who's going to have it, but I just sense that it's going to come. So I'll just finish with this one slide. So this I pulled out of, this was a researcher who had looked at actually third year medical students and the hidden curriculum, and she said, as medical educators, we do well to listen to our students. The reports of what they are learning reveal what we are actually teaching. So to see what is actually happening on the ground, we need to hear their stories. So I've put in my references, and they'll be there for the slides when Carolyn circulates them. And I have actually a lot of acknowledgments. So Dr. Leslie Burris is my mentor for the project. Nancy Craig is a research assistant. Dr. Ross Walker and Koji gave me their support from the Medical Education Office. Dr. Elaine Van Nell pointed me in the right direction from the very beginning. And all of these program directors allow me to come and speak to their residents.
questions?
Yes.
Yes.
It's maybe more of a comment than a question, and it's something that I certainly have no expert and don't know a lot about, but it's this whole issue of stories and storytelling as a way of educating and learning. It first came to my attention when I was not part of, but participating in a discussion about a research project in patient education, where they went from going and using the traditional sort of pamphlet, here's some information, to writing little stories about things that the parents then could learn from. So they would give them the story about Jimmy with croup, and that's how you would learn about croup. So I just think that what that reminded me is how powerful humans are in learning from stories. And in fact, I think we're kind of going there in a lot of forms of education. We just call these stories cases. Mm-hmm. We just call them stories instead of cases. But really, it's about this issue of storytelling. And you reminded me of that in your presentation. You talked about them telling each other their stories and how powerful it was for them to learn from each other by just talking about a story, something that happened. Probably more powerful than listing off a bunch of critical incidents and what the outcomes were.
So I really appreciate that. I'm glad that resonates with you. So the idea of stories is interesting. When you talk about cases and stories, that also resonates with me, because sometimes I'll be on the phone with the resident and I'll say, okay, so what's this patient's story, right? So you want to know what the story is. And if you look at popular culture, this is how Oprah's show comes to mind, right? These people telling their stories and people are moved by them. So I think there's a natural human tendency to be moved by stories and to remember stories. I really think we remember stories better than we remember a series of other facts.
It happens all the time, right? I mean, the patient tells you, I don't want to take that medicine because my grandmother's friend's neighbor took that medicine and died.
Yes,
you know?
Oh, I hear that.
And it's that story, that story will stick with them way longer than any statistical analysis of the number of people who died from taking this medicine or whatever.
Comment and then a question. So, the comment is about whether or not removing you as the researcher, or state collector, and having somebody not make the processes better. I don't think that having somebody from the outside is going to remove all the bias. I think residents will respond to other qualities. So, somebody outside of the institutions, they'll respond to gender, they'll respond to all kinds of things. So, I think there's always going to be a form of bias, and I think acknowledging your presence and your perspective is far more rich than saying, I'm going to remove myself. So, I don't know, I think there's value in having you intimately through the process. So, in programs like yours, we have one or two or three residents, and we talk about the power of the story. How do you present that story and maintain the anonymity or protect those residents?
I don't think you can. I really don't think you can. I think that's just going to come down to the selection of the stories that they will have to give the stories that they're, or can only give the stories that they are comfortable sharing. The cases are well known in Kingston General Hospital. It's so one sort of inpatient facility, and something happens, and a critical incident, everybody knows about it. I think we have to be careful. So, what does that say? That says that there are these incidents that are bad that nobody wants to talk about, and who's going to look after those residents, and who's going to debrief them about that? So I think the debriefing, maybe for that, the forum is not a small group or a large group or a narrative. The debrief there has to be with a role model or a mentor. But it says two things, you know. It says that there's this area that, you know, we won't get to see or we won't get to hear, and then just kind of ironically, there's this area that needs to be addressed.
Is concerned about anonymity uniform across all of the residents you talk to, or are there some folks that would be willing to have their story told? Like, is there space for that conversation after they come up with the narrative?
I think it varies, and it depends on the story.
Yeah.
So I hear two different levels actually coming out with respect to this anonymity. One is about reporting the story back as research and as it becomes public, and the other is about debriefing with the individual. And I see them actually as two distinct pieces. And so I could see how, if it's very depending on the nature of the story, you might want to debrief with the individual. In reporting it back, though, and so that was something that we really thought about as well when one of the incidents that came up, we were worried about how is this going to be interpreted. Will somebody look at this and say, oh my gosh, I know exactly who the patient is? We changed the details.
Okay.
So that somebody could not recognize it, change gender, change some things. But we left the elements of the story the same so that you would get the same impact, but you wouldn't be able to identify who was who as part of reporting the story back again.
Okay.
So I think that might be one strategy for, because they're very powerful stories, and it would be a shame for them not to be used as part of your research. The other thing as well that you can think about is that because it is, although the individual story is really powerful, but because it's a thematic analysis, you could go through and pull out the pieces of the stories and maybe generate a meta story, you know, that allows you to take the personal descriptors out and identifiers out, but still gets the point across.
So I appreciate the idea of a meta story, and Elaine, I want to tell you that the way that you described these two issues is exactly what Nancy came up with. She said, this is what's happening. These are the two issues.
Yeah, excellent.
And that you just described.
Excellent, yeah. And I've never heard a meta story, so you could be like introducing a whole new research paper.
Michelle?
I think everyone has a comment and a question. So one, I think this is incredibly valuable. I think it is equally valuable to undergrad and not more so, because I would actually argue that clerkship is probably one of the most transformative experiences,
yes,
going from the class,
yes,
to taking care of patients. And of course, like, well, my thesis work, like, my joke about the competency fairy doesn't arrive on July 1.
Yeah, so that's right.
It would be nice to have these skills at least, you know, in fetal state, if not toddler state.
Right.
Homage to Richard there. I'm curious, and I'll have to read Sue Phillips' piece, because when I did my reflection of my role analyzing data with clerks, because they told stories. Like, because I asked them, what was a good learning experience for you this week? And tell me why. I mean, that was a story. And what were the barriers to your learning this week and why? Incredibly open, and I really felt that part of, and I had multiple, so some of it was identified, some of it wasn't. I think that helped. There was like a safety net where they knew that they could tell us it wasn't necessarily from them, which is different from you. But they could use the language they were comfortable with, and they knew that I knew the culture.
Yes.
So I'm not disagreeing that it's important to have outside,
yeah,
expertise with respect to hidden curriculum, but you have to, like, there's also that from within analysis of it. And like, I just, the very first interview, it struck me because the student said, yeah, I was taking care of someone with acute MI. And
yeah,
like, they needed to be able to use the language that they use every single day and not translate that for somebody,
yeah,
who wasn't familiar with it like
that. So Nancy, you noticed that, right?
Yeah.
Because Nancy and I go through this, what does this mean? What does non-tape call mean?
Yeah.
What does, you know, that mean? And it's true, and I don't want to disconnect. That's why I jokingly said, okay, what's going to happen to me? But honestly, this is my focus, and I want to sit with them. I want to be there to sit with them and to hear them. And your part is I want them to hear how I reacted. And so I don't want to remove myself. I agree with you.
So just to make my question in, those are all comments. Why handwriting? Why not let them type?
So I think this is a real good question. It's just that at QCare, you know, they didn't bring their computers. I mean, that's something we can ask them to bring their computers and to type it. So that was, it was just to get the workshop.
And actually,
but then you still have to get it from them.
They were excellent. I could not believe how there were only very few words I couldn't understand. It's also that our students barely write anymore. Like
Nancy told,
yeah,
me that. She,
yeah,
said, you know, I'm worried about this, that they're going to write this. And that's part of the reason that I actually, the weekend before, sat down and just said, can a person actually do this? Sit down and write. And I think it was because it was short. And they did it.
I'm not saying it's wrong. It's just, it's interesting because I think,
I know.
I don't know what you think, Richard. I think in undergrad, like they're when they write, they go to a computer.
Yeah, but Michelle, I don't know, maybe I'm really old-fashioned. You should have seen them sitting there.
Oh, no.
And the thinking and the writing, it was so nice.
Some of them might actually be better with computers.
They don't write, they print.
Yeah.
Nobody writes.
Nobody writes in print.
And actually, a lot of them did print, you're right.
Yeah.
But they were, I was really impressed because I thought, I'm not going to be able to read these, but they were very good. Wasn't an issue.
Sheila?
Quick thing, I would love to assume my whole Renfrew girl might as well and get a series of approved tablets together for medicine that we could use in things like this so that we could, you know, just have they're not as expensive as a computer and have them ready for students. Or faculty, yesterday I was doing a workshop with faculty, many of them didn't bring their laptops, and I used, thankfully, the library lets me use their special computers, not their old computers on the cart, of which they have six. So, but do you know what I mean? It's like we don't have that available. Anyway, that's not, that was just a little side comment. Quick comment, the students who are in the first patient program, several of them lost a patient, the patient died, and we asked them to do some research. That research, I think, is a bit earth-shattering. First of all, where they found the material and how hard it was to find the material. The material was about what do you do when your patient dies? How do you cope, and how do you recover, and how do you take something away and make this let it make you a better person? And I have all of their references, and they did a really fine job with the references. So that might be something to think about for residency education as well. What can we do to help you? Because I'm a next step kind of a person.
No, I understand that, and I think that would be very helpful. One of the narratives that was presented in the large group at the Q Care curriculum was a resident who had to pronounce a patient and deal with the death, and the reaction that the other residents, more senior residents, gave him. And he didn't have a chance to deal with it.
And I think that's a really important thing. And one of the students actually interviewed some faculty, and he grouped them into three kind of groups. I've never thought about that, and I think I should. I've never thought about that, and I don't think I should.
Yeah.
And I can't remember. And I deal with it this way, and it was a very positive. So the people who have sort of come through it, a lot of people in palliative care, for instance.
But I really appreciate your comment about the next steps as well. So there are lots of next steps, and this has to, in my mind, this has to come out of it.
To me, that's the difference, in a way, between the researcher and the educator. In a sense, the educator can take the research and say, okay, now what do I do about this? How do I work with the students and the residents to help them address this so that this doesn't fester, or so that this doesn't become a bad role model, or so that it reinforces the good role model?
Mm-hmm.
And I did have a quick question. The 83 residents who wrote narratives?
There were 102 residents.
Okay.
We received 89 with consent.
So what was the difference there from the interviews? Like, they're obviously letting you use these 83 for the research.
Well, they sat in, so there was going to be no, they were, well, the one reason they all did it was because they had to.
Mm-hmm.
They all sat there and did it. And from my experience, I specifically said if there's something you don't feel comfortable talking about, then just don't use that narrative for this session. That was one thing. I think it was about the hidden curriculum, so there was less about patient-centered care and that kind of thing in particular cases. So I think that was it. And I think it was the format. You know, we were collecting the narratives, we were maybe going to talk about a couple, but we weren't going to sit in a group and talk about this is what's going on in your program and how you can deal with it. It was different.
I was just thinking that there might be something from that you could take if you want to pursue the interviews or whatever, or maybe this is a better way of collecting your data.
Yeah.
That's a good question.
You
talked about how a lot of them seem to focus around first experiences, if I heard that correctly. If I also heard correctly, this was a lot of these were gathered from first-year residents. Do you think that there would be some sort of developmental change in the narratives if you looked at this over at different points in time in career. So again, from clerkship through early residency, end of residency, even into early practice or perhaps later practice, that these narratives would change and what people view those entities would be good.
That would be excellent to see. That's what you would hope to see. So I think that's a great idea. And that's also why I was keen to talk to or visit with the gastroenterology program in critical. We have PGY 7 or something in the critical care program, and his insights were very valuable. And so I appreciate that. That's an excellent suggestion.
Can I just ask more about your decision to develop a written narrative? Can you say a bit more about your reasons for that? So Elaine was talking about her project last time, in which the stories were collected orally. So there's that sort of indirect component, and then they can be transcribed after. Could you say a bit more about what you thought this might be, right method?
I thought it would be the ease of collecting them. So that, they could put a narrative in a Word document and send it to us. I thought it would be really easy that way.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought with the residents, I pictured them, having difficulty. Okay, we're going to talk to you. We need to meet at this time. I pictured them at 3 o'clock in the morning typing, while they're on call or something like that. So I think it was more for that reason.
I think one of the key differences, too, is that Mel is looking at a very specific point in time, a critical incident, whereas we were looking at, over time, how what students experience have an impact on their ability to enact patient-centered care. So it lent itself more naturally to a longer interview process because we had a series of questions we really wanted to talk about, and we wanted to tease out not just the time of critical incident, but a kind of a bigger picture piece around our framework. So they're complementary, but I think they're difficult.
I like that if you have them write, because it takes a lot of time to synthesize and really reflect on your thoughts, to write it as opposed to just telling the story. It's more reflective.
I just want to go back, and several people have already addressed it, but the essential aspect that you remain doing this work as a faculty member, a researcher involved in the educational environment, because it seems to me that if it's a hidden curriculum and there's so much hesitation, the residents are so afraid to talk about the stories, bringing in someone externally to examine it just perpetuates that notion to me that this is really bad,
and we better not really talk about it. Yeah.
Versus, you know what? There's something going on, and we need to find out about it so that we can affect some change. To me, it's absolutely essential that we really talk about it, think about it, because there's an incredible paranoia, this hesitancy. The residents say it's a small town and everybody knows. I've been on call with residents and they'll go, oh, it's so-and-so and everybody knows that person. You go, I've never heard that person's name before. And I live in the same and work in the same community, but there's this generalization and this fear that makes them think everybody knows everybody and everybody's going to be able to trace it back. And I think that's because we're afraid to talk about it versus... And it's that whole movement towards adverse events occur in every hospital, actually, mm-hmm. and we need to be able to disclose and talk about it so that we can address it, the next steps. So I think it's essential you keep doing this great work. So, thank you so much, Mello. That was terrific. And yes, indeed, we'll invite you back next year. Please fill out your evaluations, which are so important for us.